One of the main charges that led to the execution of Jesus of Nazareth was lawlessness. He was accused of breaking the law himself and of spreading teachings that undermined general respect for the law and thus increased the risk of law breaking by others. On these charges, it is probably fair to say that Jesus was guilty as charged. He did break a number of the laws of his day, and he did teach other people to regard the law as being of very little importance as a guide to how they should behave. It's rather surprising then that the Christian church has come to be known as one of the most strident advocates of a rigorous and conservative obedience to the law, and the closest supporter of the work of state law enforcement bodies in punishing those who break the law. You only have to listen to how much of the vocal opposition to same-sex marriage is motivated by a rigid reading of biblical law. There are all sorts of questions of law and obedience and discipline swirling around in the Bible readings that we heard read tonight. And I think they both shed some light on how this strange paradox came about and on how we are called to live in light of it. The words of Jesus that we heard from Matthew's account of the gospel have come to be known as a classic text of church discipline. If someone has offended, go and raise the matter with the person alone. If that doesn't work, go with two or three others, and only if they still won't face up to their wrong, take the matter to the whole church. These words have been used over and over as a model for an in-house judicial procedure for dealing with those in the church whose behaviour breaches the rules and expectations of the church community. It must be said that at times keeping things in-house has been used as an excuse for cover-ups, and we've been deservedly condemned for that in places like the recent Royal Commission. But what is mostly taken for granted is that this teaching of Jesus is intended to provide a model for structuring the practices of discipline and dealing with offenders. There is, however, a problem with this that sits there like a kind of unexploded bomb in the middle of the passage. What does Jesus say to do with the person if they still don't repent at the end of the process? He says, "Let such a one be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector." And who's saying this? Jesus. And how does Jesus generally behave towards Gentiles and tax collectors? He welcomes them, befriends them, parties with them, and gets himself in all manner of trouble for being far too buddy-buddy with them for the liking of his generation. Let such a one be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Coming from Jesus, if that's a recipe for church disciplinary procedures, they are not going to have a lot in common with the structures of punishment that we're used to. So there we have a big clue to Jesus' attitude to law and discipline, and perhaps a good example of why his teachings were seen as undermining the principles of law and order. Perhaps where we've got ourselves mixed up with this text is that we've tried to read it through the lens of a view of God that is pre-Christian. And so we've seen it as being roughly analogous to the events that reached their climax in the story that we heard tonight from the book of Exodus. Now, we've jumped a whole lot of material into Sunday readings between last Sunday and this Sunday, but if you've been doing the daily readings or you're familiar with the story, you will know that Moses has been ramping up the pressure on Pharaoh by bringing progressively bigger and bigger disasters down on the nation of Egypt, a bit like what seems to be happening to the nation of the United States just at the moment. Well, that hurricane wasn't big enough, here's a bigger one. This has been happening in Egypt in order to persuade Pharaoh to release the Hebrew slaves. Now, this is exactly the sort of law and order that we understand, because this is normal human political practice. If we want to bring about a change of policy in a foreign power and they won't bow to reason, then we resort to threats of force and we gradually escalate the level of force until they yield to our will. This usually works, although the current escalation of tensions between Donald Trump's America and Kim Jong-un's North Korea suggests that it may break down if the leaders are crazy enough. But usually it works. And because we are always so sure that we are unquestionably right, we invoke the name of God to sanction our controlled use of force to bring about our picture of justice and freedom and peace. We see ourselves as God's agent, doing God's will, and stories like this one from Exodus are used to justify our belief that this methodology which we are employing, the escalating level use of force, is God's way. Now, if we've unquestioningly accepted that as our worldview, as our framework for understanding what God is like, then it's no surprise that we hear Jesus' words about going to a sinner alone and then with a couple of others and then with the whole church as simply another example of this same process of escalating levels of force. Or at least we will, until we trip over the unexploded bomb in the middle of the passage. I think that the reading that we heard from Paul's letter to the Romans really detonates the bomb, and perhaps gives us some hope of making some sense of the pieces that remain after the explosion. Paul does two things here. Firstly, he completely puts the law in its place by saying that if we love one another, we will already be fulfilling the law, and therefore we can pretty much forget about the law. In other words, to those who have truly followed Jesus in the way of love, the law is pretty much an unnecessary irrelevance, which makes it pretty hard to sustain the argument that would prohibit gay people from loving each other on the basis of the law. Love, according to both Jesus and Paul, takes precedence over law. But secondly, Paul points to some of the reasons why we demand the law, why we deemed the law to be necessary in the first place. He points to quarrelling, jealousy, the desires of the flesh. The purpose of all human systems of law is to keep things like jealousy and quarrelling and competing desires under control within safe bounds so that they don't escalate into war and bloodshed. That's why there is such a fear about Jesus undermining the rule of law. What will keep things in check if the law is no longer respected? The trouble with human desires is not that desire is wrong in itself, but that we humans have a pretty much universal tendency to get competitive about our desires. When we see other people desiring things, the value of those things increases in our eyes and we begin to compete for the possession of those things. If you don't believe me, go and sit with children for a little while and note how often a pencil or a book or a toy can sit there completely ignored by all of them until one of them picks it up and then suddenly at least three of them all want it at the same time. That one and only that one. Some of the same-sex marriage opponents actually sound a bit like those children, I reckon. Marriage is ours. Don't let them have it. So human desires almost always become competitive and therefore create quarrels and jealousies. They turn us against one another by turning us into rivals. And we need to create systems of law that will kind of contain it and keep it all from turning ugly. And when it does turn ugly, we need systems of legalised punishment to identify offenders and take out our need for vengeance on them. It's kind of a big pressure relief valve that breaks the cycle. Because whenever getting even is actually left in our hands, instead of being placed in the hands of the state, then an eye for an eye actually keeps escalating into some kind of massive destructive feud that can boil for years. But the apostle here is making the same radical step that Jesus makes. If we follow Jesus in the way of love, he says, we don't need the law. We can forget it. Why? Not because we have a new, improved system of law and discipline endorsed by Jesus, but because the practice of genuine love renders law and discipline obsolete. Love does no wrong to a neighbour. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, neither Paul nor Jesus are saying that simply tossing out the law is a good first step that will solve all our social problems and bring an end to war and violence. Both of them would, I'm sure, acknowledge that in a world where love is not widely practiced, the law does in fact work to maintain some sort of social equilibrium. But what they would say is that it achieves that by force, by a willingness to write some people off, to give up on them, to lock them up and throw away the key, to sacrifice them from the community. The most radical and earth-shattering thing that Jesus is saying in his proclamation of the good news is that that is not God's way. Most of the world's religions, including the most widespread understandings of Christianity, attribute our practices of law and punishment to God. But Jesus says no. God is no Jekyll and Hyde. God has no interest in punishment. God's desire is always and only for mercy and reconciliation. God is not offering us a new improved system of law and discipline. However, as long as we keep casting jealous eyes on one another, we will probably need to keep resorting to some sort of system of law and punishment. But what God is on about, as seen clearly in Jesus, is actually doing away with the need for that. It's not so much abolishing the law as abolishing the need to have the law. Owe no one anything except to love one another. Love your neighbour as yourself. Last week we heard Paul saying that the only thing he'd encourage anyone to compete over is showing one another love and honour. So what we've got here is a way of salvation. A way that can save us from the spiral of rivalry and violence and vengeance. And this way of salvation has nothing to do with following rules. What it does instead is give us a way to stop imitating one another and becoming jealous of one another. Although it acknowledges that, it being human, we're naturally imitative, so it invites us to imitate Jesus instead. It invites us to imitate Jesus in his reckless and extravagant love for others, including the Gentiles and tax collectors. Remember them? It invites us to imitate him in pursuing love instead of discipline, reconciliation instead of vengeance. If we do that, then the so-called church discipline process described in Matthew 18 actually becomes not a process of escalating force, but of escalating invitations to reconciliation. And if it all fails at the end, it results in the offender being treated as one who is to be welcomed and accepted and loved and honoured, albeit now as a troublesome guest rather than as a member of the community. But loved nevertheless. It's no wonder that this was regarded as dangerously subversive by the authorities in Jesus' day, and no wonder that it continues to be treated pretty much the same today. It's no wonder that we constantly try to find justification in the teachings of Jesus for systems of law and social control and divinely sanctioned punishment. What happened to Jesus when he seriously pursued this was that he was regarded as a threat to social order and stability. And since it was deemed better that one die than that the whole nation be destroyed, he was sacrificed by his society. But in case there was any doubt that his radical new vision of God and of the ethos of God's kingdom had the stamp and approval from God, God raised him from the dead on the third day. And Jesus proved by his own actions that even the murderous hostility of the authorities and the crowd could not make him vengeful and punitive. He stands before us still, as he stood before them, as he will stand before us at this table in a few minutes, reaching out to us with wounded hands and inviting us to turn our backs on the ways of jealousy and vengeful discipline and to join him on the pathway of love and reconciliation and life.